Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. National Book Award-winning author Nathaniel Philbrick joins us to talk about his new book, Travels with George, in Search of Washington and His Legacy. The book traces Washington's journey as a new president through the 13 former colonies. What's revealed is that the early makings of America were, in many ways, as divided and fraught as our country is today. In the fall of 1789, George Washington, only 6 months into his presidency, set out on the first of four road trips as he attempted to unite what were in essence 13 independent states into a single nation. In the fall of 2018, Nat Philbrick, his wife Melissa, and their dog Dora set out to retrace Washington's route across the country. Welcome back, Nat. Good to see you.
Oh, it's great to be with you again.
All right. So where did this idea for the book and the road trip come from?
Well, you know, I had just finished my third book about the American Revolution, and I was done with war and bloodshed. I just needed a change of scene. But I had also found myself surprisingly fascinated with George Washington. You know, I never saw it coming, but by the end of that trilogy, I just wanted to know what happened to him next. And I've written now, you know, 12 books of straight history. They involve a lot of research. I'm either at an archive or in my office, burrowing in. And I just wanted to get out and see this country. And one of my favorite books is John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, in which he and his standard poodle, Charlie, travel the country. And I was thinking, how could I do something like that? Well, it turned out that when George Washington became president, he realized, you know, he was the leader of 13 essentially independent states. He needed to do something to bring them together. This was before mass media, before you turned on your TV and saw the president. You had to go out there if you were president and visit the people if you're going to make a lasting impression. And so that's what he did. He got in his carriage and traveled to all 13 states. And I thought, well, what if Melissa and I and our dog Dora, staying in the Steinbeck tradition, followed George Washington? We have a Honda Pilot we keep in Hyannis. We'll start there and follow George around the country. And thus was born Travels with George.
Yeah, little did you know how timely this would actually end up being. And you write in the preface, love him or hate him, Washington is a historical figure with whom all Americans must reckon. To ignore Washington is to ignore the complicated beginnings of the United States. We cannot remake our country's past, but we can learn from it. And all of us still have a lot to learn from George Washington. That's an understatement, I think.
When I conceived of this, I saw this as, hey, this will be fun, see the country, follow George Washington. But already, the country was falling apart in many ways. You know, there was a political divide. Confederate statues were being removed across the South. And the divide just felt like it was getting wider and wider. Little did I know that once we completed our journey, we'd be hit not only by a pandemic, but an unprecedented call for social justice, in which slavery was no longer at the periphery of the conversation. It was the conversation. And so that the travels Melissa and I and Dora had took on this real relevance. How do we as a country, we're so divided, how do we pull us together? And it seemed to me that to gain this perspective, look at what George did at the very beginning to pull this country together. He was not perfect by any means. He was a slaveholder. And so this book just seemed to be resonating with relevance, not only through our travels, but especially through the writing process.
Yeah. And we'll get into the slavery part of it, but his first stop was Alexandria. And it's interesting to note that while we sort of have this image of this wealthy, you know, guy, right? He owed a lot of money in Alexandria. I was a little bit surprised by that.
Oh, yeah. We have this image of him as the country squire, the richest man in America at the time. But the fact of the matter was he was land rich. Mount Vernon was thousands of acres, and he owned a lot of land in the western part of the state. But Mount Vernon was losing money every year. He didn't have any cash. And so he had accumulated all these debts in his hometown of Alexandria. And it was a huge embarrassment for him. He didn't want to become president owing all this money. So he hit up a friend of his for a loan to try to pay those debts off before he headed out. And so Washington was not the richest man in the world. He was not a billionaire. At this time, he had this huge sprawling estate with more than 300 enslaved workers, but it was a money-losing venture, and he was just trying to hold it all together as he became, of course, President of the United States.
You mentioned you brought your dog Dora along for most of the trip. Why, and what was George Washington's take on dogs?
Yeah, well, why? Oh, my wife, Melissa, had that question. Why? Why, Dora? What does this
why
have
are we
to
bringing
do?
The dog?
Yeah, why are we doing it? We're going to have to stay in dog-friendly hotels, and we did. But for one thing, it was the inner Steinbeck calling to me. We just had to bring a dog. The other thing is I love dogs. Dora was a young puppy, a Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever with high energy, and would she be something that would be a conversation starter? And the other thing is George Washington loved dogs. He pretty much single-handedly developed the American Foxhound. And so his dogs had names like True Love and Tipsy. And it was a big part of his life at Mount Vernon. So I convinced myself, if not Melissa, that Dora, it was perfectly appropriate that Dora accompany us on our travels across the country following Washington.
Well, it's a good idea, actually, because dogs are good conversation starters. And Dora did help in some ways with, chatting with some folks. But getting back to Washington, in his entourage was Billy Lee, his manservant, who had a close relationship with the president. And that relationship is said to perhaps have contributed to Washington's changing views about slavery. Tell us a little bit about Billy Lee.
Yeah, Billy Lee, except for Martha Washington, there was no one closer to Washington than Billy Lee. During the 8 years of the American Revolution, Billy Lee was with him almost with every step. He was his personal body servant. That meant that he was there with him in the beginning of the morning. He was there with him at the end of the day. He was also responsible for coordinating events and personal matters related to the army and his Washington's position as commander in chief. He was there at every step. And by all accounts, he was as close to Washington as anyone could be. He was also a great horseman. When Washington in his younger days was a big fox hunter, Billy Lee was the one organizing the hunt. And so these guys, if not joined at the hip, were joined on horseback. They were there with every step of the way. And unfortunately, in the years prior to Washington, after the revolution and before Washington became president, Lee suffered two accidents in which he basically busted up his knees to the point that he could hardly walk. In fact, needed help in that regard. And so by the time Washington headed for the presidency, Lee was not in great shape, but desperately wanted to be with Washington as he became president. And so was part of that initial entourage, although it would become clear he really had to stay back in Mount Vernon for most of Washington's presidency.
You mentioned the country was divided at that time, in both politically and regionally. And early in his presidency, Washington could have made the argument for freeing slaves. Why do you think he didn't do that at that time?
Yes, he's been criticized by historians who make the claim that if Washington, as he was being inaugurated president, publicly stated that as the leader of a country based upon the principle all men are created equal, I cannot in good conscience keep enslaved people as in my household, that he might have changed the country and set us out on a course that would have led more quickly to the emancipation of the enslaved and made the Civil War not happen. You know, I think that's being a little historically naive. The South, as other historians have said, is if Washington had made that statement, it would have been incredibly divisive right at the beginning. What was already a very tentative union of states would have been fractured at the onset, and you know, the infant republic would have broken in half at the beginning. You know, and I think it comes down to, you know, the fact of the matter is Washington made this judgment call. He had made the personal vow that he was going to free his slaves at some point. He wouldn't do it until after, upon his death. He had a very complicated situation at Mount Vernon, where the enslaved workers he owned had intermarried with the enslaved workers attached to the estate of Martha's deceased husband, and so it was a very complicated endeavor, and yet you know, Washington does make this call that the Union at this point is something that he needs to go with. You know, it's very easy for us now to look back. So many of our country's problems are related to this, and to judge Washington very sternly for it. And it's ultimately we are left with Washington making that judgment call, and whether or not he might have, through the sheer force of his personality, pulled it off, who knows? But I think there is a tendency to overestimate how in control he was at the beginning. He wasn't. There were so many things trying to pull this country apart.
Interesting bit of history I did not know. In Trenton, New Jersey, at that time, any adult, man, woman, white, or African-American who lived in New Jersey for a year and was worth at least 50 pounds could vote.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's, can you imagine? And what would happen? You know, it was, you had to own some property, of course, and but it was unique. And Washington arrives there and he's greeted by a group of women who herald his arrival. And I think for Washington, who by this time had been feted in, you know, every city he had gone to with toasts and, you know, overwhelmingly male proceedings, I think his reception in Trenton was a great relief. Of course, New Jersey would change when the Anti-Federalists came in, the Thomas Jefferson Virginia dynasty. They perceived that the women were predominantly voting for the Federalists, the opposing party. And so the state legislature would change that law in the early 19th century. But I think it is fascinating to know that at this early point in our country, New Jersey was different.
Change the people who can vote if they're voting against you.
Yeah, I mean, some things really have never changed, and you know, so you have to go to the past to see that we are not the only ones grappling with so much of this.
You write, when given the choice, Washington seems to have preferred the company of women over men, and he did, and especially articulate women. And we should say this isn't in a womanizing way. He intellectually just preferred the company of women, right?
Oh, absolutely, Nathaniel Greene's wife, Katie, was a primary example. She was highly intelligent, vivacious, and beautiful. But you know, there was no one who was a more interesting conversationalist than Katie. And this was just the type of person Washington enjoyed to talk to, where, you know, it wasn't a smoke-filled room where people were trying to get a political favor from him. This was just honest intellectual conversations, which he immensely enjoyed.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about George Washington, his presence. He was tall. You know, he rode on that white horse. He, you know, had the military uniform. Talk about, he rides in the carriage, but before he comes into most of the towns, he gets onto his horse. He looks to be this, you know, epitome of confidence, right? But really, he had quite a bit of anxiety. So tell us a little bit about George Washington, the man, for a moment.
Well, you know, going into this, he really did not want to be president. This was the last thing he wanted to do after spending 8 years trying to win the American Revolution. But it was clear there was no one else who's going to pull it off, who was going to unite the people to the point that they would accept the new government and under the terms set forth by the Constitution. So he very reluctantly went into it, and he just could see all of the divisions that would ultimately take over this country. He just knew they were coming. And so, you know, you get this, he, in his diary, in his letters, this huge sense of dread, you know, and even all the praise and the accolades he received in each city he went to, he would just say, this is, it was like a dagger in him, because he just knew, you know, once my administration starts having to do things like tax the people, this praise will inevitably be translated into just as enthusiastic criticisms. And so he could just feel it coming. And yet he knew he had this window at the beginning of his presidency where, you know, it was novel. He was the most popular man in America, if not the world, at this point. He had this chance to use that popularity to make people understand they were not necessarily living just a town or a state, they were part of the United States. And so he also knew, after 8 years as commander in chief of an army, how to make an impression. As you said, he was tall, very tall for that era, between 6'2 and 6'4 inches, 6 feet, 4 inches tall, huge feet and hands. Thomas Jefferson said there was no better, more impressive man on a horse than George Washington. And that's saying something in the late 19th century, when everybody rode a horse. And he had this great big white charger named Prescott. He would pause before he came to a town or a city, get out of his carriage, dressed in his general's uniform, get on that great big white horse, and ride down Main Street to immense applause. And, you know, today we go to a political rally and there's rock music and huge screens and all that. Well, I think Washington really started all that in a way by, you know, creating what was for that time in America, a very impressive display, coming to you, you know, in your local town, whether it be in New England or the Middle Atlantic or the South. And Washington was, you know, trying to use that power of his personality to create, you know, to not heroicize himself necessarily, but to create a sense of legitimacy for a country. You know, and that's the thing that's different about him. You know, he could have so easily turned this into a cult of personality. You know, it's all about me, the great warrior. He was trying to use that popularity to create a country in which no one was more important than a country of laws.
We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. So we know that he had these little bits of anxiety, and this idea of he's just a man pops up, right, through many instances. That's what he thought of himself. I'm just a man, right? But where does all this come from?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things when I set out to research this book was I wanted to know not just what Washington was experiencing, but what the people in each town he visited were experiencing. You know, what memory of his visit was still left? And so I reached out to the historical societies and libraries of just about every town he visited and asked them, you know, for what did they have? And I was getting letters, I was getting pages from history, local histories written in the 19th century, you know, with all these testimonies of people late in life remembering when they were a kid and George Washington came to town. And so, you know, this was, you know, really interesting to sort of see, you know, how people were responding. And one of the stories that would get told over and over again in town after town, and, you know, and was Washington making a real effort to say, look, I am not the greatest man in the world. I am nothing but a man. You know, initially, when I heard that, it's, yeah, right. You know, that's what he was saying. You know, how can you trust this said by, you know, a 90-year-old man remembering when he was seven, you know, that kind of thing. But they kept springing up in more than a half dozen different towns in New England and several towns in the South. And Washington, and it really makes sense. Washington was making a concerted effort to say, look, I may be your new president, but I am also like you. I am one of the people. I am not a dictator. I am not a king. I am one of you. And one of the ways he really underlined that was by insisting that I am not going to stay in the houses of private individuals. I'm going to stay in taverns, public taverns. Now, public taverns in the late 18th century were, you know, riddled with fleas, horrible beds. Food was even worse. And two taverns, Washington was even turned away. They didn't recognize him. They didn't want to be bothered late at night. I mean, so he was going to the equivalent of our down on their luck roadside motels, and here he
roughing
is.
It, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, these I am only a man anecdotes, I think really speak to his attempt to try to, you know, say, hey, I'm coming to see you. Yes, I'm your president, but I'm coming to you as a fellow citizen.
It's interesting to note some of the anxiety that he felt and you know, that uncertainty of what lie ahead. His inaugural address draft was 73 pages, and as you write, and cataloged in embarrassing detail all his reservations and fears. Luckily, he sent that to James Madison to look over. But tell us about you. You visited Federal Hall in New York City, where every April 30th, there's a reenactment of Washington's inauguration. A little different than maybe what the real inauguration looked like.
Yeah. Well, you know, I during this journey, we would go to places where there were reenactors or interpreters of Washington, and there at Federal Hall in New York, Federal Hall was the site of the original Federal Hall where Washington was inaugurated. It's a different building, but it's on the same site. They underneath the rotunda, have a reenactment of Washington's inauguration. There's an actor with a white wig portraying George in his brown suit. He wore actually made in Hartford, Connecticut, a humble brown suit. And they have someone there, you know, doing his Washington shtick along with the other two officials who swore him in. And he presents him, and then he reads Washington's inauguration address, and it's he's forceful, he's commanding, he's very much like the presidents you know, we've seen in our own lifetimes, doing their imitation of what it's thought George Washington was doing when he became president. However, if you look at the firsthand accounts of people who are actually there, there is one of a woman who is 15 on a rooftop right across the street from Washington, who is on an upper story balcony as he was sworn in, who says that, you know, Washington was basically shaking like a leaf, that at one point before he was sworn in, he became so overwhelmed as he looked at the crowd, he fell into a chair. You know, he had been overcome. You know, this was not a scripted move. This was not a president feeling in command. I am taking over the country. This was a president who felt on the verge of a journey that he had no idea where it was going. And then when it came to reading his address, other accounts from a senator from New Jersey, or actually Pennsylvania, saying that, you know, this was the man who could stare into cannon and you know, not flinch. Before us there, as he read his address, he was shaking like a leaf, and he felt bad for it, that he wanted a president who was firmly in control, and yet Washington at this point was anything but.
What's really fun about the book is all these things we learn about Washington, but also your Melissa and Dora's sort of travels and experiences in between some of this history that we're learning. And I have to say, when you started the sentence of lying on the floor at Penn Station, I thought, why in the heck is he lying on the floor in Penn Station? and that was, go ahead and tell that story. That was a chapter called Dreaming About George Washington, right?
right. It is the story of our journey and Washington's. And one of the things I think people don't know about George Washington's beginning as a president was, within weeks of becoming president, he was hit by a series of medical issues that nearly killed him. It became clear that the tensions, the stress of the office, the lack of exercise was not good for him. And so he had these series of illnesses that, you know, we could have lost him in that first year. Well, in the midst of following George Washington, Melissa and I were in New York, and I was due to speak that night in Philadelphia. So we needed to take the train. We were in Penn Station. And that night, we had some kind of flu or something had hit us that just drained us completely. And everything was going fine. I was about to get on the train. I stood up with my backpack full of books, and suddenly I passed out. And I fell down, and I get, Melissa wakes me up, and I, you know, groggy, I get up, and the policeman is coming towards me, Amtrak employee. I'm saying, hey, I'm fine. We'll get on the train. And then I collapse again and I'm out. And that time I dreamed, I had a dream of George Washington. We were in his carriage, that weekend I had watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with my granddaughter.
That's right.
You know the flying car, and which I think influenced my dream, because in my dream I'm in Washington's carriage. We're in New York, leaving New York, on about to begin the New England tour, when the carriage leaps into the air. We're up there. And we're looking around, there's the East River, there's the Hudson River, whitened with sails. And then we land in Rye, New York, where he spent his first night. And I, you know, I'm like, I wake up, and by the way, I was just dehydrated. I was fine. But it was while researching the book, I learned that N.C. Wyeth, the great artist illustrator of, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, all this thing, he was working on a painting, a mural of Washington coming into Trenton, you know, surrounded by the ladies of Trenton. And he was up on a scaffolding when he slipped and almost fell 30 feet to what would have probably been his death on the stone floor of the bank. And that night he had a dream, and he dreamed of George Washington. And the painting he produced from that dream, he dreamed that George Washington appeared before him to show him, to give him a blow-by-blow tour of the Battle of Brandywine near where he lived in Pennsylvania. And it's now become my favorite N.C. Wyeth painting. It shows him with his easel and all that, looking, talking to George, who's on his white horse, as the events of the battle happen around them. And so, yes, in many ways, I felt like I was not only following George, but living with George, the ups and downs of his presidency.
Nathaniel Philbrick's talking about his book, Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. His visit to Boston was interesting, perhaps because of his rocky relationship with Governor Hancock. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, prior to the Constitution, when, you know, we were a federation, the country was a federation, all the power was in the states. the governors were the ones with the preeminent power. The Congress was unable to even directly tax the American people. And then with the Constitution, things changed. There was now an executive-led federal government. And this meant the president was, you know, above the governor, theoretically. Whether or not this was going to be accepted was yet remained to be seen. Now, Washington had had a fairly rocky relationship with Hancock during the Revolution. And when he went to Boston, he noticed that John Hancock did not show up when he was greeted by public officials in Cambridge before his entrance into the city. Hancock claimed he was not feeling well, that gout was the culprit, but that he would love Washington to come have dinner with him later that day. Washington did not take this very kindly, and when Washington returned to his quarters in Boston, he wrote a letter to Hancock informing him that since Hancock did not come to meet him, he was not about to come to Hancock's house. That, you know, in this new republic, a governor must pay deference to a president, not the other way. The letter went to Hancock, delivered the letter, realized he had grossly miscalculated. You know, he was a very popular man in Boston, but it was clear after Washington's reception in Boston that no one could compete with the new president. And so he sent his apologies and was loaded into his carriage and made his appearance at Washington's quarters. Washington would eventually go to Hancock's house, but the message had been delivered. I mean, we take it for granted. It's almost laughable that, you know, who outranks a governor? Of course, the president. But that's only so obvious because Washington did not accept Hancock's dinner invitation back in 1789.
You had a really interesting encounter in Kittery Point. Melissa found an ad for the Red Cottage, and in the description it reads, "On October 2nd, 1789, George Washington came ashore on the stone pier in front of the cottage to attend the Congregational Church at the head of the lane." Turns out the owner was related to Tobias Lear. So tell us a little bit who Tobias Lear is and this chest that hadn't been opened in 80 years.
Yeah, well, I tell you, John Steinbeck says in Travels with Charlie, that you don't take a trip, you know, a trip takes you. It's the unexpected that really is what drives any traveler. And this was brought home to us in Kittery Point, Maine. We were, Tobias Lear was Washington's personal secretary. He was from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He was a kid. He was, you know, in his late, in his 20s. And he was, you know, like any political operative, you know, eager, hardworking, and he was now a local hero because of his relationship with George Washington. And when we visited Portsmouth, I discovered that, you know, he not only went to Portsmouth during a harbor tour, he took a boat across the river to Kittery Point, Maine, where there was a stone dock that he disembarked from and visited the church. And we needed to stay somewhere, and we thought, well, what about Kittery Point? So Melissa looked it up on the internet, and you know, there was the Red Cottage in Kittery Point, looking over the stone pier once visited by George Washington. We go, what? So can we stay there? Well, we weren't able to stay there, but the owner, Jim, said he'd love to talk to us, and that not only did he own the stone pier that Washington stepped on, he was a direct descendant of Tobias Lear. And this was like stepping into a historical vortex. And what made it all the more incredible for me was when Tobias Lear died, he had a group of papers that sort of no one quite was sure where they went. And it wasn't until the 1920s, when one of his descendants was going through in this red barn right near the cottage, rummaging through there, found this old trunk, opened it up, and there was Tobias Lear's notebook from when he was Washington's personal secretary, listing every financial transaction of the presidency, all this personal information. This man would then write, publish it, use it, the basis of a book about Tobias Lear and his relationship with Washington in the early years of his presidency that had been a huge help to me. And then through the internet, stumbling upon not only someone who, you know, lived at the site, but was a descendant of Tobias Lear, was just, you know, amazing. And so it was one of the more astounding, fortuitous things that happened along our travels with George.
Yeah. Talk about a researcher's dream come true when you have something like that drop in your lap. And now certainly the route Washington took is vastly different today. It doesn't look like it did when he did it. So why did you insist on taking these back roads rather than the highway? And what did you learn by doing that?
Yeah, well, particularly in New England. Whenever I would go to a town north of Boston, I would typically take 95 and then take the exit for the town. And, you know, then you take a few turns and there you are in the town. You're basically parachuting into the town. And, you know, it's highly disjointed. And, you know, each town becomes, if you visit it that way, each town becomes, you know, a commuting town, you know, not part of or an organic whole. By following Route 1 and in some cases Route 1A up from Boston to Salem, Massachusetts, we followed a route that would inevitably become each town's main street. You know, as you left the town and then you followed meandered your way through. And then once again, you were on Main Street. And suddenly it made so much sense. All these towns were a part of an organic whole that I have to admit, I was born in Boston. I have lived in New England most of my life. I think I know the state fairly well. But it wasn't until we followed George that I really got a true sense of, you know, how these communities were united geographically and almost organically in the 17th and 18th centuries.
When you look into someone's life and legacy, you uncover things that are upsetting. I think the story of Ona Judge is one. Tell us a little bit about what you learned there.
Yeah, it was in Portsmouth where we came upon what I call in the book the pocket of horror in George Washington. When Washington would free his enslaved workers upon his death, the only slave-owning founding father to do so. But the fact remains that when one of their household's enslaved servants, Ona Judge, she was personal servant to Martha. They were in Philadelphia when it was the temporary capital of the country, and Ona left the presidential mansion, got on a schooner that eventually took her all the way to Portsmouth. She escaped, and Washington was outraged. Ona was a part of the household. Martha felt betrayed, and so he sent out a advertisement for, you know, escaped slave, all of this. And eventually he was able to track her down to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And this was late in his presidency. It was in his second term. He was used the power of the presidency to reach out to the local authorities and ask their assistance in securing Ona Judd. You have to give the inhabitants of Portsmouth some cred here, because when contacted by Washington, they did reach out to her, talk to her, and Washington had been under the illusion that she had been convinced by someone to leave. But no, she left for only one reason. She wanted to be free. And the official refused to do anything to bring her back. And but Washington then, in the last year of his life, would once again try to bring Ona back. She was part of Martha's deceased husband's estate. Technically, Washington could, there could have been a legal action against him if one of the household's enslaved workers escaped and he did nothing to find her. But that does nothing to justify that, late in his life, even though he's made the decision to free his own enslaved workers, he sends yet a relative of Martha's out to retrieve her. She luckily gets out of the household before he can catch her. And, this is the pocket of horror in George Washington. He was a slave owner. And to the very end of his life, he did not recognize that someone such as Ona wanting to be free was what this country was all about.
Yeah. I think it's also surprising. I mean, we know that there was slavery that happened in the North, but to the extent the North was involved in slavery was a lot more than I think people think. You write, it's been estimated that 60% of the slave trading voyages launched from North America originated in Rhode Island, in some years as high as 90%. When Washington visited Newport, the slave trade in Rhode Island had been outlawed for 3 years, but that appears to have had no effect on the city's slave traffickers. In fact, Newport's biggest year in slave trading was 1807, 20 years after the supposed ban. And then, later when you visit Brown, you write, I had no idea how intimately involved not just Brown, but all of Rhode Island was in Southern slavery.
Yes. And, Northerners often have this, well, it's a Southern issue. It's not. As our visit to Rhode Island made clear, New Englanders were intertwined with Southern slavery to a degree that it make it so obviously a national issue. Rhode Island in particular, though, Rhode Island operated as kind of the commissary for the South. That dedicated so much of their agriculture to producing cotton that they needed meat, wheat, all of these things that Rhode Island was at the forefront of providing. And then also all of New England was, we all know, full of cotton mills. And these were mills throughout the New England towns that used Southern cotton to create textiles. And so that, this was completely interwoven. And I think it was appropriate for us to visit Rhode Island, just as Washington had done before the Southern tour, because it made it clear to both of us how slavery, this was definitely a national issue, and that, yes, there was Southern slavery, but it was the support system provided by the North that it allowed it to flourish.
Yeah. Tell us why Washington thought it so important to visit Rhode Island. They had not yet ratified the Constitution at this point.
Right. Rhode Islanders have always been Rhode Islanders. The first to declare their independence, the last to join the Union. And when Washington did his first New England tour in the fall of 1789, Rhode Island had not yet ratified the Constitution. So what does he do? He makes every effort not to go to Rhode Island. The route he takes avoided, the way 95 goes through there, Rhode Island. He took the inland route and avoided Rhode Island entirely. He was sending a message, I am not going to visit you until you're in. And then in June of his second year, he gets the news that Rhode Island is now a part of the Union. Now, he might have, as the prodigal son, he might have said, well, the heck with you, and turned his back on them. But instead, he hopped on a schooner, sailed from New York, which was then the temporary capital before it moved to Philadelphia, and sailed to Newport and then Providence. And the Rhode Islanders were astounded. They had not even participated in his election. And yet here he was making the effort to visit them. And it was really, talk about reaching across the political aisle. And it was successful in turning the state that contained more skeptics, perhaps, than, any other state in the union, into some of his biggest supporters.
You say, quote, "What worried Washington more than anything else was what might happen if a president's chief priority was to divide rather than unite the American people." What do you think he would think about today?
Well, I don't think he'd be tremendously surprised by the political divisions we are experiencing. By his second term, the opposition party, he was technically a Federalist. The opposition party would be called the Republicans or Democratic Republicans, led by ultimately Thomas Jefferson, who was his own Secretary of State, which was, don't have to get into it, but that's another book. But, Washington's own cabinet contained one of his biggest political, what would become one of his biggest political rivals. And so he was, by the end of his term as two terms as president, he was deeply frustrated by the political divisions that had taken over this country. And they were just as bad, if not worse, than anything we are experiencing today. But what I think would really trouble him are the efforts to undermine the credibility of our laws and government. Washington spent 2 years of his presidency traveling to just about every town in what was then the United States of America to establish legitimacy of a new federal government, a government of laws, to have active efforts to undermine the people's faith in those laws, I think would be deeply upsetting to Washington. Because, this is, what he set up is only as good as the American people are willing to follow those laws. And once we start tampering with that, we are betraying the legacy Washington worked so hard to create.
What did you take away from the tour? You had certain ideas about Washington going into this. He became even more relevant as you and Melissa and Dora took this journey. What did you walk away thinking?
Well, I came walking away thinking, yes, our country is divided, but when you visit these towns, it doesn't necessarily feel that way. I think we are still part of America. The other side of it, I was amazed by how far Washington had traveled. And I don't mean this in how many miles he clicked off traveling around the country. I mean this in his life. This was a guy who became a slaveholder when he was 11 years old, when his father died and inherited some enslaved workers. And he's a man who goes through all of the revolution, which clearly changed him. He begins to realize that the assumptions of his childhood are flawed. Thomas Jefferson would record a comment of Washington made during his presidency that if slavery should ever divide the country, he would go with the northern part. That's an extraordinary statement coming from a Virginian. So, yes, Washington was flawed. Washington, as everyone is, and bound by the preconceptions of his time, he questioned some of them, which is more than a lot of us are willing to do. So I came away with an immense respect for this country and Washington's contribution to it, realizing that, yes, we are a flawed nation. We were begun by flawed people, but there were ideals driving those people back then. That all of us are created equal, that there is such a thing as a union that transcends any state, any town, any person. And I think if we can do our best to stay true to those ideals, there will always be hope for this country.
Nathaniel Philbrick's new book, Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. We'll have a link to the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Now, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure once again.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.